It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
You're tuned to another edition of Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC, coming to you in the New York, New Jersey metro area and worldwide at mybradio.com, mybradio.com, and of course on the 77 WABC app. I'll just repeat it quickly. Thank you very much for keeping us in the top 10 in New York AM radio, according to Nielsen. It's an honor that our great listeners have bestowed upon us by your listenership. This great show, brought to you every single week on 77 WABC, discusses the questions that are in your mind. We discuss sales, social media, corporate culture, emerging technologies, leadership, strategic planning, entrepreneurship, financial planning, time management, hiring, and so much more. Stay tuned for tonight's edition of Mind Your Business, where you'll gain solid advice to get you ahead in today's business world. Well, as we do each week, we open with some thank yous. Special thank you to the great team here at Bottom Line Marketing Group, who plays such an important support role for this show. Cirilli, Ben, Rena, Miriam, Dina, Hoodie, thank you. And of course, to the great folks at 77 WABC, Alex, Matt, Chris, Brian, Justin, thank you. Also, a special shout out to the various channels that Mind Your Business is syndicated on. Mishpacha Magazine, the most recent column that they featured in the Take 5, was the interview that I had with Dick Schulz, the chairman emeritus of Best Buy and the founder of Best Buy. What a fantastic interview. To see the Mishpacha piece, subscribers get it naturally. You can pick it up on your newsstand. I'm not sure at this point if you can still pick it up on the newsstand, but you can access the interview itself that I had with Dick by going to mybradio.com, mybradio.com. That's the great resource to access all past guests that we've had, Captain Sully Sullenberger, Jeffrey Hazlett, the CEO of Dale Carnegie, and so many other fantastic guests. What about John Sculley, the former CEO of Apple and Pepsi? What great insights he shared on this program. You can access that one if you like to listen to it as a podcast or just on your computer, mybradio.com, mybradio.com. In addition, we have a robust YouTube channel. Tonight's show is going to be on the YouTube channel. And that is, you just go to Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis, or you can access it again by going to mybradio.com, mybradio.com. Well, without further ado, going to our very, very special guest. In studio, we have none other than Mr. Alan Fagan, Executive Vice President at the Orthodox Union. Some background. Prior to joining the Orthodox Union, Mr. Fagan attended Harvard Law School and worked as a partner in a prominent law firm, Proskauer Rose. Did I get that right?
You did.
I did. Proskauer Rose.
Proskauer Rose.
Okay. The Orthodox Union is the world's largest Jewish resource with departments dedicated towards social action, advocacy, public policy, kashrus, and so much more. OU Kosher is the largest division within the Orthodox Union, certifying over a million products in over 83 countries. I'm going to repeat that. OU Kosher is the largest division within the OU, the Orthodox Union, certifying over 1 million products in over 83 countries. Well, tonight we are going to discuss with Alan some of the lessons that the corporate world, could learn from the nonprofit sector or vice versa. There's certainly some good play for either sector and what we could learn from it. And someone with your stature certainly could share quite a bit on that. How and why to harness the power of the Jewish demographic and how to maintain a standard of excellence throughout a large multifaceted organization such as the Orthodox Union. With that intro, we give a very warm welcome, Alan Fagan. Thank you for joining me here on Mind Your Business.
Yitzhak, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's a special treat. Special treat. Well, I like asking this question to really any guest, and really that makes all the guests that we had on Mind Your Business, someone that that really has accomplished so much in life. Tell us a little bit about the journey. And I know, by the way, the show is only 45 minutes, so we'll have to keep the answers
I'll keep the
concise,
journey short.
But, yeah.
My journey may be a little bit unusual for an executive in the not-for-profit world. I spent most of my professional life as a practicing attorney. The last part of my professional life as the manager of one of the world's largest law firms, probably close to 40 years as a lawyer and as the chairman of our law firm. So my route into the nonprofit world was very much as a volunteer for most of my professional life, volunteering with various organizations, including the Orthodox Union. Mm-hmm. When I retired from the practice of law, I was asked to assume the position of executive vice president, in effect the CEO of the OU. I thought about that for a couple of months. I really had anticipated retiring, fully retiring, and devoting myself as a volunteer. But the mission was really so critical, and I saw this as an opportunity to do as a professional what I had anticipated doing as a lay volunteer.
Very special. So you, instead of hanging up your cleats, decided I'll jump back in and use decades of experience and bring it to the nonprofit world.
Yeah, in effect, I traded one pair of cleats for another.
Well, the Orthodox Union is an umbrella organization that provides so many services. Perhaps in a nutshell, it's really an impossible question, but I'll ask it anyways. Perhaps in a nutshell, you could just give a brief view what the Orthodox Union does.
Sure, I can try. It is a daunting task because of the enormously broad range of programs and services that we run. Mm-hmm. I think we are probably best known in the world for our kashrus division, our kosher certification business. As you indicated in your introduction, we are the world's largest kosher certifying agency. Well over a million products and ingredients, operations in over 80 countries, with a very, very large share of the kosher certification market. That is one very substantial aspect of what the OU does. But unlike other certification agencies, we take the proceeds of the certification fees that we receive and plow them all back into community service programming of a whole variety of types. We run an enormous youth movement through our NCSY division. We have a very, very substantial program for adults and children with disabilities through our Yachad program. Mm-hmm. We operate on campuses across the United States in educational and social programming on campus. We are one of the world's largest birthright providers. We have an enormous array of services that we provide to our member synagogues. Mm-hmm. We have a huge advocacy organization, both in Washington and in various states, in which we engage in political advocacy and public policy related issues. So we run a whole variety of educational, social, recreational programs all across the United States and Canada. Substantial operations in Israel, where we maintain OU Israel, which is our Israel center. Much of that activity is educational in nature, a good deal of youth-related activity. We have programs for disadvantaged Israeli youth in 20 development towns across Israel. And we have operations in several foreign countries, including Argentina and mm-hmm. Chile.
Wow, somehow you got that into 2-3 minutes. Now, going back to what you mentioned before about Proskauer Rose, I mean, what was your position there?
Well, I started as an associate in the law firm, mm-hmm. As an entry-level associate. I became a partner in the firm where I practiced labor and employment law mm-hmm. On behalf of management. I became the head of Proskauer's labor and employment law department. And in 2006, I became Proskauer's chairman, wow. In effect their CEO, a position that I held for 6 years. And after that, at the request of the management of the firm, I played a leading role in building several of our offices around the world, and then retired at the end of 2013.
And then yanked back to the OU.
And then started again.
Wow. So what lessons, if I may, did you bring along from Proskauer, or I shouldn't say specifically from Proskauer, from your life experience that from, you know, to the Orthodox Union?
Yeah. I mean, it was from Proskauer. I think my career was probably fairly unusual in the sense that I only worked for two employers in my entire professional career. I spent 1 year as a law clerk to a federal judge, so my employer was the United States of America. And then I joined Proskauer, where I stayed for my entire professional life, close to 40 years. That's fairly unusual now. You see lots of folks moving and often moving on a fairly frequent basis from one company to another, from one industry to another. I stayed with the same firm, which I loved, continued to love, for my entire professional career. The lessons that I took were really, I suppose, in two categories. One are lessons that you learn as a practicing lawyer, which very much revolve around solving problems for clients, identifying problems and trying to create solutions for those problems. And that's, I think, a very, very useful set of background and skills that can be used in almost any kind of enterprise. For-profit, not-for-profit. But I also managed a very large enterprise for the last 6 years of my career. Proskauer, when I left, had about 750 lawyers, about 2,000 employees. We had 13 offices spread across the United States and the world. I opened a number of those offices. So managing an enterprise of that size, I think, was enormously useful. As I came to the OU, not quite the same revenues as...
We'll get to that. I'll challenge you with that soon.
as a law firm. But the OU has probably close to 2,000 individuals who are on our payroll. Operations across the United States, in Canada, in Israel, multiple departments, a very, very substantial budget. So the need to have an effective manager at the helm of an enterprise of that size and scope and breadth was enormously important. I was able to import the skills that I had developed in managing a law firm to now managing one of the largest Jewish not-for-profits in the United States, indeed probably in the world.
So you would concur, a nonprofit of this size, to a degree, really does need to be run like a business. And I guess the next part of my question is if there's any other particular differences between the business world and the nonprofit world. Or maybe those are two very different questions.
No, I think it's a very fair question. Okay. I'm not sure that a not-for-profit needs to be run as a business, if you use that in its broadest sense.
True.
That is necessarily with the same motivations,
right.
Same sets of values and mission.
I'm referring to the mechanics.
But the mechanics are, I think, enormously important. What every well-run business requires, what every well-run, I should say, organization requires, is a dedication to efficiency, to making sure that money is being spent in the most efficient, economical way possible in order to accomplish the goals, the mission of that organization, and maximize return on investment in the case of for-profits for their shareholders or their owners, in the case of not-for-profits for the community. If you're using community dollars, you have an absolute obligation to make certain that they're being used as carefully and as well and as economically as they possibly can. That requires the most efficient management that you can. The other aspect is to be sure, and this is true for any organization, that the services that are being delivered are being delivered with the highest quality, with the greatest professionalism, and that the recipients of those services are feeling that their needs are being responded to in the most professional way and with the greatest degree of responsiveness.
My guest this evening is none other than the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, Mr. Alan Fagan. A very special treat. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Hey, Joe, give me a minute. I'm going to run the numbers and circle back next week. Post it on Facebook, LinkedIn. Just get it up there.
You're great at what you do, and you're busier than ever. We get that. Imagine if you could devote every minute of your day to running your business and taking it to the next level. Enter Bottom Line Marketing Group. Bottom Line Marketing Group focuses on making your company look great so you can focus on growing your business. To see some award-winning projects produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group, visit www.bottomlinemg.com. That's www.bottomlinemg.com. Or call CEO Yitzhak Saflis on his direct line for a free consultation at 718-412-3505. That's 718-412-3505. Bottom Line Marketing Group. Marketing solutions to grow your bottom line.
Are you ready to scale your business? On Monday, June 18, join other executives at Montclair State University for the Winning Edge 2018, a one-day business conference designed to help you take your business to the next level. Reserve your spot today by visiting winningedge2018.com. That's winningedge2018.com. Hear from world-renowned keynote presenters like Jeffrey Haislip, Stephen Shapiro, Alan Fagan, Michael A. McIntyre, and others for valuable insights and strategies to help you tackle your most pressing business challenges. Visit winningedge2018.com to view the full lineup of presenters and for more information about the business conference presented by Saul N. Friedman & Company and produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group. Space is limited. To secure your spot and walk away with real takeaways which are certain to propel your business forward, visit winningedge2018.com today or call 718-412-3508. That's 718-412-3508.
And we're back. Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this evening is none other than the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, Mr. Alan Fagan. Again, Alan, thank you for taking of your very precious time joining me here on Mind Your Business. Very special. The OU has many branches, as we discussed in the in the past segment of this program. OU Kosher, which is the largest, we touched on, and there's programs for those with special needs, youth programs, advocacy. How do you ensure, and this is really a question that perhaps even goes back to your Proskauer Rose days, how do you ensure excellence throughout the many divisions within the Orthodox Union?
So I think there are a variety of things that that we do and a variety of things that I think any nonprofit can do. First and foremost is to be sure that you have in place the finest array of talent that you can get. We're blessed as an organization with an extraordinary group of program heads. Ultimately, it's their responsibility to run their programs, to ensure the quality of their programs, the responsiveness of their programs, to think about the strategic direction and redirection of their programs. So I think that's really, in many respects, the beginning and the end of any effort to have a first-class set of programs. We have among our program heads folks that are running departments that would be substantially larger than 80% of the not-for-profits that operate in the United States. They each have very, very substantial budgets, large number of staff. NCSY, for example, our youth division, mm-hmm. has 200 full-time employees. It's in and of itself a major not-for-profit if it was spun off as a standalone organization.
The same is true of Yachad, our program for individuals with disabilities. Our campus program is operating on 23 campuses, has a staff of close to 100 educators and support personnel. So I think that's the beginning, is to have the finest staff that you can assemble. And we're enormously lucky in that regard. We also have put into place over the last several years since I began a very, very robust program of evaluation of every program and every department. We do, at the beginning of the year, during our budget process, we require every department and every program to submit in advance a specification of their goals and objectives for the coming year. We require that they attach to every one of their goals and objectives some objective measurement, some metric of how the success of those efforts can be measured. And then we meet twice a year, once at the midpoint of the year and once at the end of the year, to see where every program, every department stands vis-a-vis the goals and objectives that they set and where they are on the metrics of performance. And then throughout the course of the year, we're in constant discussion with our departments about everything that they're doing, every issue that arises, and we make midterm adjustments during the course of the year to be sure that our programs are accomplishing the purpose that they need to.
Alan, I have to ask you this question that I'm sure is on everyone's mind as they're listening to the show. You make it sound like being a CEO is a piece of cake. I'm sorry. You put it out, it's like so simple.
It's not. What it is an enormous joy. I don't think it's a piece of cake. But I'm surprised that there are, certainly in the not-for-profit world, lots of organizations that don't seem to put the same time and attention into ensuring the quality of what they're doing, and more importantly, that what they're doing is actually aligning with their mission, is carrying out the purposes for which they were established. One of the things that I said to our department heads when I first started, shortly after I started, was that I sensed within our organization, and maybe it's true of many not-for-profits, that we tend to manage by anecdote. That is, you hear from a program participant or from a parent, my son, my daughter, was so blessed to be participating in the following program. It was great. It was wonderful. The staff was fantastic. They got so much out of it. And then we all smile broadly, and we pat ourselves on the back, and we think we're doing a terrific job. And maybe we are. But we don't know that based on those notes, right, those letters, or those comments. We need to be much more objective, much more introspective. We need to really take a careful look at ourselves in the mirror and say, you know, is every penny that we've spent being spent well? Is every program that we're running being run in an optimal way? Is every program that we're running meeting the needs of the population that is designed to serve? And if we're not constantly asking those kinds of questions and insisting that we continuously do better, we're not serving the populations that we need to be serving appropriately.
You know, it's such a fantastic point that you raise. About anecdotal feedback is nice, may feel good. Obviously, if it's complimentary and if it's critique, it doesn't feel great. But it should not, kill the initiative because of comments. I've run into this many times. We're working on some grand initiative for a client, and one person made a comment and it just knocked him off his base. And he rethought the whole thing. Wasn't looking at objectively because one person made a comment.
That's absolutely right, and I think it works in both directions. Those sporadic, anecdotal comments shouldn't motivate a change in a program simply because they're made, because they may be outliers. But nor should a handful of very positive comments suggest that we're doing it all right. when there may be lots of room for improvement. So we have now engaged in a massive thrust of making certain that we collect as much program data as we possibly can collect, that we make management decisions based on information and not solely on anecdote, not rely on our gut instincts, but try to analyze the way a sophisticated corporation would, whether what we're doing is optimal or not.
But if I may, I'm also going to add another point, because I know this comes up with feedback. There may be listeners that are thinking to themselves, okay, let's say we'll evaluate this constantly and maybe on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, and also try to, I mean, obviously a nonprofit has to keep costs down and keep costs in check, but not realize that they need to still put in the proper fuel into the tank in order to get it done right. Meaning I'll have some that will say, well, you know what? Marketing is not important. Not realizing that, the OU does a great job marketing, and in many other areas. I'm not just harping on marketing, where if they feel the resources are key, and I know we've seen this from Teach Advocacy, or their consultants, or their relationships that are needed in order to attain a certain goal, there's no problem to make that investment. I mean, it's not just looking at it in a critical way and so that we figure, okay, we really don't need this, we need that. If we need it, we'll use that, but we have to ascertain that we need it.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think the question is how one goes about evaluation, right, and whether some of the more sophisticated management techniques of evaluation are appropriate to import into a not-for-profit. My own view is absolutely that we have that obligation to do that. We need to look at where our resources are being devoted, how they're being deployed, mm-hmm, and areas where we need to double down by providing additional resources.
Now, as the in effect, the CEO of the Orthodox Union, if I may, want to discuss the power of the range of the Jewish demographic here, let's say in America, North America. In America itself, I believe the statistics are that approximately 2.2% of the population is Jewish, and again, that's including all, you know, the entire range of the Jewish community. And in New York State itself, it's actually around 8.3% of the population. Perhaps you could, you know, discuss the Jewish demographic and its market value.
It's like the American Express commercial. Okay. It's hard to put a value on certain things. We are an interesting demographic. Obviously, a very, very small population in relation to the total population of the United States, but we're a very active population. Mm-hmm. I think you see disproportionate numbers of Jews in academic disciplines, mm-hmm, and the professions and so on. We are also, if you look purely at the research data, a more affluent population than the general population in the United States. I think a better educated population on average. I think 60% of Jews in the United States have college degrees. And there are certain characteristics, I think, of the population from the perspective of how they act as consumers that are probably somewhat different than others. For example, and this is purely instinctive, mm-hmm, which is something I rail against doing, but let me share the instinct. I think Jews, on balance, probably travel much more than the average population, whether they're traveling for business or they're traveling overseas as tourists. Many in our community have children and relatives who live in Israel, mm-hmm, and so the travel of the Orthodox community to Israel is extraordinary. So they're making use of the major carriers that are taking them there. and the hotels that are servicing them there. So we have some very, very unique characteristics and some that are reflective of more reflective of the average population.
Mm. So in terms of corporate America, and I ask this, you know, again from the OU side because of OU Kosher and the again the staggering number of products that are certified by the OU, there seems to be great value for corporate America to keep an eye on this on the Jewish demographic.
I think there's no question. Certainly in segments of goods and services that one would market to a population with the demographic characteristics that the Jewish population has, I think that's clearly the case.
As a, you know, obviously as myself, an Orthodox Jew and keeping kosher, you know, and I've traveled around, actually around the world, and pretty much wherever I go, I could, you know, I'm rest assured that I could find a product with an OU, you know, insignia on it, and therefore know that I could have kosher. Perhaps you can explain, I know you touched on this earlier, but, you know, 83 countries, you know, over a million products, the scope is mind-boggling. I don't know where to begin with this question. You know, what kind of manpower or supervision does this entail of being responsible for kosher certification in such a vast way?
Yeah, it's an enormously large and complicated portion of our enterprise. The kosher laws themselves, as you know, are enormously complex. And so those that act as mashgichim, as certifiers of kosher standards, have to be very, very well versed in Jewish law and practice as it relates to kosher food and dietary restrictions. Mm-hmm. And they are enormously well trained in that regard. The industry itself is fascinating. When we talk about a million products, we include ingredients, and much of the need for substantial numbers of staff relate very much to ingredients as opposed to plant certifications. We now provide certification, I would say, in approximately 10,000. 10 to 12,000 plants. But the number of ingredients that they're using, someone who's using a particular spice that comes from, you know, a place in China or India that you and I can neither spell nor pronounce, right? That ingredient needs to have a certification. Every ingredient that goes into a kosher product needs to be kosher.
Right.
And so hence the far-flung nature of this enterprise. Now, some of those certifications may only require, you know, two or three visits a year to the plant. Other kinds of production facilities require constant supervision or fairly constant supervision. Mm-hmm. Really depends on what it is that's being produced and what the nature of the production process is. But that's what requires a very, very large supervisory staff to be able to make those visits, certify those products. We also have a huge investment in computerized the computerized ability to access, have our customers have the ability to access ingredient lists. So, for example, an OU customer that's thinking of creating a new product.
Mm-hmm.
Has an online database that they can access so they can figure out every ingredient that they may need in that product, every preservative, every chemical, to check whether it's kosher,
right,
and if so, what the sources are for the ability to obtain that product from an OU-certified company.
So vast. So complicated.
Fascinating business.
Yeah, and then we just... you know, the Jewish community hopefully doesn't take it for granted. You know, they could just walk into a store, traveling certainly throughout America, And I remember on a recent trip to San Francisco, just I didn't fully prepare myself with the food needed for the trip. But fortunately, just went into a store and the products were there. Right. OU, boom, I'm good to go.
And the wonderful thing now is the vast array of products that now carry our certification. We hear these stories constantly. San Francisco is easy, right?
Wow.
But people that have come back from really far-flung corners of the globe and said, I was stuck in such and such a place, and I went into the local supermarket, and I looked around the shelves, and I was so happy to see that little OU on a package.
Fascinating. Fascinating. My guest this evening is none other than the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, Mr. Alan Fagan. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Okay, so you're considering a comprehensive medical exam, but you haven't decided where. At Elytra Health in New York City, we know you have a tight schedule and that you only want the best. We also know you have choices to consider. Well, consider that you could have a world-class executive longevity exam at Elytra's state-of-the-art Manhattan Center for Life and Longevity, right in downtown New York City. Think about the fact that the experts at Elytra Health are a hand-selected staff with more than 30 years of experience in executive exams and concierge medicine, and that top doctors in the area refer their patients to Elytra. Something else to weigh is that cardiac imaging, cancer screening, labs, and all other testing is completed in a single five-hour visit with white-glove service. Plus, you'll receive the results, advice, and follow-up coordination before you leave. Finally, consider how easy it is to get peace of mind from an Elytra exam now by visiting ElytraHealth.com. That's ELITRA Health.com. Elytra Health. Well, above all.
Are you ready to scale your business? On Monday, June 18, join other executives at Montclair State University for the Winning Edge 2018, a one-day business conference designed to help you take your business to the next level. Reserve your spot today by visiting winningedge2018.com. That's winningedge2018.com. Or call 718-412-3508. That's 718-412-3508.
And we're back. Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saftlis right here on 77 WABC. My guest this evening is none other than the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, Mr. Alan Fagan. In case you're just tuning in now, good news. By Tuesday morning, the entire episode will be up on our channel, mybradio.com, mybradio.com, and you'll be able to listen to this fantastic interview. And I thank Alan for taking up your precious time to join me here on Mind Your Business. Really special. Before we go into some other questions that I'd love to ask you, one of the areas that we happen to be here at Bottom Line very close to and with is the advocacy work that's done by the OU through the Teach Advocacy Network, run by our very dear friend Maury Litwack. Perhaps you could talk about the OU's advocacy efforts, whether his or even the great work you're doing in Washington.
Sure. Our advocacy efforts are essentially divided into two primary components. We have an office in Washington where we engage in federal level advocacy, and we have a state and local effort that operates primarily in New York, New Jersey, Florida, California, and Pennsylvania. The federal advocacy efforts are very much directed at advancing the interests of the Orthodox community in particular and the Jewish community in general.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those efforts are fairly traditional pro-Israel advocacy efforts,
mm-hmm.
but we also concentrate on issues that are of much greater concern to the American Jewish community, and often in alliance with other faith communities within the United States. So just by way of example, in the last several years, we've seen terrible, terrible tragedies involving hurricanes and flooding in a variety of communities. We learned in that process that FEMA, the emergency...
Right, Federal Emergency Management
System. Management arm of the federal government, did not provide services or funding for disaster recovery to houses of worship. We have advocated now for the last several years to remove that restriction and to have houses of worship, churches, synagogues, mosques, treated no differently than any other not-for-profits would be treated by FEMA. That's a battle that we've just won.
Wow. Congratulations.
And we've seen the regulations, the FEMA regulations, change so that now houses of worship will be treated on a par with other not-for-profit instrumentalities. Security is an enormous issue for our community and for others. So we advocate on a regular basis for Homeland Security funding so that faith communities that are in jeopardy from a security perspective can get the funding to install cameras, install appropriate doors, and so on. And that's been very, very effective advocacy. Our advocacy on the state and local level has concentrated almost exclusively on the ability to bring appropriate state funding to yeshiva and day school education. Let me give you two sets of numbers that I find fairly astonishing. In New York State, for example, 15% of the school age population attends non-public schools.
That high.
That high. This is K through 12, 15% of students in New York State are going to private schools, parochial schools, mm-hmm. being homeschooled. They're not going to public schools. That 15% of the school population receives approximately 1% of New York State assistance to education. New York State education budget is somewhere in the vicinity of $26 billion. Mm-hmm. About 1% of that is going to non-public education, even though 15% of the school-age population is not in the public school system. We think almost by definition that that is not only very bad policy, but carries with it enormous unfairness. To parents who have made the choice to school their children in some way other than in a public school. Now you look at it from the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
Our research indicates that the cost to educate a child in the public school system is somewhere in the vicinity of $20,000 per child. Mm. When you have 15% of the population not in public schools, think of what the savings is to New York State on not having to educate those kids. And if the schools that are out there that are servicing that 15% were to close down because they are financially unable to continue their mm-hmm. operations, the school would pick up a burden that we estimate to be somewhere in the vicinity of $10 to $12 billion, if you include the capital expenditures
right.
that would be necessary to construct the necessary schools and classrooms and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Those two polarities, those two sets of figures
mm-hmm.
Strikes us as enormously unfair and actually very bad policy for the state of New York that has an interest in properly educating all of its students, not just the students that go to public schools and choose
right.
to do so.
Right.
And we think and have said publicly, repeatedly, that we think the public schools need to be appropriately funded. But there are parents who choose for a whole variety of reasons
right.
not to educate their students that way. We're not suggesting that there needs to be absolute equivalence,
right.
but a ratio of 15% and 1%
is certainly an imbalance.
It is an imbalance that needs to be rectified. We've been advocating vigorously over the last number of years to begin to address that imbalance, and the New York State Legislature has responded, and to his credit, the governor. Governor Cuomo has I think, made very, very substantial efforts to increase the amount of funding that is going to non-public education in appropriate ways, in constitutionally permissible ways, and in ways that don't jeopardize the appropriate funding of public schools. And we've seen, based on our advocacy over the last 3 years, that state funding has essentially doubled for non-public education. It's a very, very important part of the advocacy work that we do. Mm-hmm. We do it in cooperation with other Jewish groups, other faith communities. We think it's enormously important work.
Special. Again, just another division within the Orthodox Union. My guest this evening is Alan Fagan, the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union. We're going to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we will ask a couple of more questions and wrap up. Stay tuned.
Are you ready to scale your business? On Monday, June 18, join other executives at Montclair State University for the Winning Edge 2018, a one-day business conference designed to help you take your business to the next level. Reserve your spot today by visiting winningedge2018.com. That's winningedge2018.com. Hear from world-renowned keynote presenters like Jeffrey Haislip, Stephen Shapiro, Alan Fagan, Michael A. McIntyre, and others for valuable insights and strategies to help you tackle your most pressing business challenges. Visit winningedge2018.com to view the full lineup of presenters and for more information about the business conference presented by Saul N. Friedman & Company and produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group. Space is limited. To secure your spot and walk away with real takeaways which are certain to propel your business forward, visit winningedge2018.com today or call 718-412-3508. That's 718-412-3508.
And we're back. Mind Your Business with Yisroch Saftlis right here on 77 WABC and around the world at mybradio.com, mybradio.com. My guest this evening is none other than Alan Fagan, Executive Vice President at the Orthodox Union. Alan, if I may, we've talked about leadership earlier in the program, but as Executive Vice President of such a massive organization, again, you touched on it, roughly 2,000 employees. What does a day on the job, quote-unquote, look like? Am I putting you on the spot? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just, I'm not sure I could pick an average day. One of the great joys of being in a job like this is that no 2 days look the same. In fact, I often comment that when I walk into the office in the morning, you know, unless I've got a meeting that I knew about in advance, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the day may look like. But I think there are probably a couple of key buckets of functioning that take up a large part of my time. One obvious bucket is the management of the organization, mm-hmm. Making certain that when we have openings for senior positions within the organization, that I'm spending the requisite time in that search process and in the interview process for our key mm-hmm. leadership, mm-hmm. Relating to our lay leadership, our president, our executive committee, our board of directors, and the day-to-day management of the departments and the programs, meeting with them on a regular basis, resolving questions that may come up, modifications in budget that need to be made. We're currently in our budget process. That takes us several months during the course of the year. So that's probably one bucket of activity. There's a second that I would put under the general heading of strategy and vision. Trying to think through not just how we manage what it is that we're doing, but how we begin to conceptualize, envision what it is that we should be doing. What we should be doing more of, in rare cases, what we should be doing less of, new projects, new programs that we should be tackling, where we're going to find the funding to be able to engage in those in those efforts. We have put most of our departments now through a very robust strategic planning process. So engaging in that process with them in terms of thinking about where we are today, where we need to be 5 years from now and beyond, is an enormously important part of the management of the enterprise. And then there's a third bucket, which probably for lack of a better word, is kind of the ambassadorial function. We are often called upon to represent the Orthodox community in gatherings of other Jewish groups, in gatherings of other faith communities, in explanation to a whole variety of audiences, speaking engagements before various groups, and things of that nature. And that takes up a very substantial part of my time as well. So depending on the day, I may be doing all three, I may be doing one of the three, or it may be one of those days where you walk in and you do none of the three and try to figure out at the end of the day where your day went.
Only a couple of minutes left. You know, let's be honest, you touched on this earlier. Obviously, the salaries in the nonprofit sector, you know, don't compete with those in the corporate world. You know, what's your advice to someone who who's in the corporate world, but you know is motivated, has aspirational values? What's your advice to them when they may have to quote unquote take a pay cut, but doing something for the good of mankind?
Right, that's a very hard thing to advise about. First, I would quarrel a little bit with the premise.
Okay.
There's no question that at the top of the corporate pyramid, earning capacity is radically different than at the top of the not-for-profit pyramid. For the vast majority of people working in our organization, the work that they would do in the for-profit sector, I don't think would remunerate them radically differently than they would be paid in the not-for-profit sector.
Fair point.
And we try very, very hard to look at external labor market data. When we set our compensation, I put into effect 2 years ago a salary administration system for two purposes. One, to be sure that we were paying commensurate with market for the vast majority of our positions. And second, to guarantee internal fairness. So that we were not determining compensation based on who was in a job, but rather what the job should be paid, which I think was also a particularly good development for the very large number of women who are in our organization. So we've now eliminated compensation inequity by looking at jobs rather than people. So that's one piece of it. Obviously, everybody has to weigh what it is that gives them satisfaction in life and the trade-off between working in a communal endeavor where your ultimate ability to earn is going to be very, very different than what your ability may be if you're an entrepreneur or working in a service industry like a law firm or in the corporate world. That's a very fundamental issue that everybody has to decide for themselves. I was very lucky because I was able to come to this at the end of a career. I was going to retire from my law firm. I didn't opt to just say, okay, I'm going to leave in, when I'm 35 years old or 40 years old and go in a whole different direction. I had my entire career behind me as a practicing lawyer and enormously grateful that that enabled me to make that transition without having to be concerned about financial aspects. But here's the point that I think is enormously important. I am struck every day of the week at the numbers of young people who come to us seeking employment because they're mission-driven, because they want to devote their lives and dedicate themselves to helping other people. It's enormously gratifying to see this incredible pool of talent some of whom have left the corporate world, not because they were unhappy with it, but because they saw their lives going in a different direction. Mm-hmm. They saw their satisfaction deriving from other values. And I give them enormous, enormous credit for being honest with themselves and having the courage to say, I'm going to ignore some of those trappings and some of the good life that comes with it because there's a very different meaning and purpose in my life.
So special. Alan, we're out of time. It went by pretty quick.
It did.
Thank you so much for joining me here on Mind Your Business. Wow.
My pleasure, Yitzhak. Thank you so much for having me.
Please. Wow. In case you just tuned in or within the last few minutes, no worries. By Tuesday morning, this entire episode of this really fantastic edition of Mind Your Business will be up on the channel, mybradio.com, mybradio.com. Well, that wraps up another great edition of Mind Your Business. Tune in again next Sunday night for another great edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC. Okay. Wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Special.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Safliff. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Safliff has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.